After that, he moved through a number of appointments at Harvard University, Princeton University of Chicago, CNRS in France, the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, the University of Michigan, until he hit the big time here at the University of Pittsburgh, when in 2001 he was appointed the Andrew Mellon Professor, which he holds in the Mathematics Department, and it's my pleasure to invite him to speak to us on the topic of computers and the future of mathematical proofs.
Let me just run over the abstract first. It's relatively common for the mathematical proof of a single theorem to run hundreds or, well, more rarely, thousands of pages. It's also become common for mathematical proofs to rely on computer calculations. An editor of one of the most prestigious mathematical journals has recently declared that it has become impossible to find peers who are willing to review computer code. As a result, the journal has started to publish theorems without any meaningful review of the underlying computer code. What do these developments mean for computers and the future of mathematical proofs? Let's start out with a mathematical proof. Here's proof that 1 plus 1 equals 2. In the perfect realm of mathematics, 1 is the successor of 0. We use the recursion relation for addition to move the successor over to 1 plus 0. Then we use the base case of addition that 1 plus 0 is equal to 1. And we get the successor of 1, which is finally 2. The hope of many mathematicians is that all proofs should be as simple as this, but in fact, it has not turned out that way. I should say that last weekend I was at a presentation of the American Association for Advancement of Science, and let me just read a word from the abstract there. That abstract says, for 2,000 years, mathematicians could claim that the notion of a mathematical proof provided a path to absolute truth, unique among the sciences. But with the appearances of computer-aided proofs, that earlier certainty has started to slip away. I saw things slip away quite literally at that presentation. I had a PowerPoint presentation that crashed just as I was about to start the presentation. When I rebooted, the presentation had disappeared. The session was called Paradise Lost, and I had called my presentation Presentation Lost in preparation. So it was a good reminder that technology and computers are not always perfect and don't always do what we want them to. But actually, proofs become quite complicated from the very start. I want to start with the very first proposition of Euclid. The very first proposition is to take an edge, which I'm sorry, it looks like we've got things cut off on the right, but we take this edge at the bottom of the screen, and the first proposition asks us to construct an equilateral triangle on that base. And, well, the very first error in Euclid occurs in the very first proposition. The construction tells us to draw two circles. The first circle is at A. The missing point on this triangle is B off to the right, and it's a circle centered at A running through B, and the second circle is centered at B running through A. And then Euclid takes the point C to be the point of intersection of those two circles. But of course, if you look at the postulates of Euclid, there's nothing that guarantees that two circles, each passing through each other's centers, must intersect. And this is not just a slight gap in the reasoning. Really, you need some notion of, say, continuity or completeness to be able to assure that these two circles will intersect. And so it's an error that's not easily fixed. Closer to our time, there's a famous problem called the problem of 13 spheres, or the Newton-Gregory problem, because it goes back to a famous discussion between Isaac Newton and the astronomer Gregory. The question is, if we fix a sphere such as the one we see in the center of this diagram, How many other spheres of the same size can we get to touch the one in the center without any of them overlapping? Now, the discussion centered on whether the answer was 12 or 13 spheres. If you look at this particular diagram, there's an arrangement in a hexagon of six green spheres around the red one in the center, and there's room for three on top of that hexagon. Two of them are shown, and the other one fits in the pocket where you see the red sphere. And then on the back side of the hexagon, there's room for another three. So we get layers of three, six, and three for a total of 12 in this particular arrangement. But Gregory thought that it might be possible to arrange them in a different way to get 13 to touch. The first proofs or claim proofs did not appear until the 19th century. There are three proofs appearing in the 1950s, including one by Leach. It turns out that the proofs from the 19th century are all incorrect. These mistakes were not discovered until quite recently. One of the proofs from 1952 is wrong as well. But Leach's proof made it into what is called proofs from the book. So for those of you who don't know proofs from the book, this is it. Erdős had this notion of proofs from the book, which were the most perfect proofs that anybody had ever produced in the history of mathematics. These are proofs that are not capable of any further improvement. And here's a collection that was made by Eigner and Ziegler a few years ago of such proofs. And the proof of this 13-sphere problem, showing that 12 is the maximum possible, made it into the book. Let me quote one line from the book. You have two triangles. If two side lengths stay the same and the third one increases, then the area of a triangle increases. We see this illustrated with these two triangles. I increase the edge to the left and I get a bigger area. Of course, this only works for some triangles. If we look at the next two triangles, I increase the length of the edge to the left in this case, and the area in this case is getting smaller. So what we have here is an error in the book. This mistake was finally corrected in the second edition by entirely removing the chapter from the book. I want to talk about a few different theorems in mathematics before eventually coming to the topic of sphere packings and the Kepler conjecture. I want to start with what is probably the most discussed theorem in mathematics because of its complexity and length, and that is the classification of finite simple groups. So for the non-mathematicians in the audience, a group is just a collection of symmetries. If that collection is finite, then it's called a finite group. And these symmetries come up with things such as Rubik's cubes and wallpaper patterns. For instance, you use group theory to show there are exactly 17 possible wallpaper patterns. Simple groups are ones that can't be broken down into more elementary pieces. For instance, some of these, none of these, in fact, in this picture are simple because they can be broken down into translational symmetries and rotational and reflectional symmetries, and they break into different subgroups in this way. So the famous classification problem was started in 1963 with the 250-page paper by Feit and Thompson. This paper made long papers in group theory the norm. According to one group theorist I recently talked to, it said that it made papers, long papers inevitable and respectable. The completion of the project was announced in 1983 by the principal architect of the project, Denny Gorenstein. By the time it was realized that the announcement was premature, there was a major unpublished gap in the proof. Gorenstein had died. The project was not actually completed until 2004 with the publication of a 1,221-page paper by Aschbacher and Smith. And the project is so complicated that even experts have difficulties in some cases determining whether a given paper is an essential part of the proof or not. This example was very influential for me in my perception of mathematical proof because I had two important members of the project team, Thompson and Conway, as teachers the same year that the completion of the project was first announced. Let me just read a couple of statements about this theorem that have recently been published from Ron Solomon, January 2006, in the Bulletin of the American Mathematical Society. Researchers may now proceed with more confidence to quote this theorem as a tool in their investigations of other mathematical structures. And Aschbacher, I have described the classification as a theorem, and this time I believe that to be true. On the other hand, 10 years ago, while I often referred to the classification as a theorem, I knew formally that this was not the case. Second theorem I want to mention is what's called Almgren's big paper. Geometric measure theory is the study of geometrical shapes such as soap bubbles and foams that minimize areas. So I've shown an example of a nice foam here to the right. And you see that this foam is made up of nice, smooth surfaces, not a rough surface like a crumpled up piece of paper. And it's this theorem that Fred Almgren proved in complete generality in 1984. The proof turns out to be 1,728 pages. It was written over a long period between 1974 and 1984, and then not published for an additional 16 years. One remarkable thing about this is that, according to Gene Taylor, one of the editors for the publication, there are no known gaps in this long proof. This was also influential for me because he finished this result in Princeton just as I was starting my graduate work, and one of my graduate student friends became a student of his and, as part of his graduate work, had to work his way through the 1,728 pages. My advisor, I want to show you a couple of pages so you can get a feeling for what it looks like. It's extremely technical, and it goes on like this for a very long time. My own advisor was Bob Langlands. There's a branch of mathematics called Langlands theory in his honor. And the proofs in that area tend to be long and complex. I just pulled out a couple of the page lengths of proofs in this area. Some of Langlands' own papers are 548 pages, 139 pages, 337 pages, 237 pages. Then I picked a researcher whose work is most closely related to my own in this area, Jean-Louis Valsperger, and I just listed the lengths of his papers between 2001 and 2005, 166 pages, 107, 162, 40, 449. And the important thing to realize here is that these are not textbooks. These are not books about an entire subject area. These are single, isolated results proving a single theorem in mathematics in each case. So if somebody were to write a book about the whole area, it would be the lengths of these things combined, and then much more. Another interesting recent example is the Poincaré conjecture. This is a well-known conjecture because it became one of the lists. There's a famous list of seven clay problems in mathematics for which there's a $1 million prize if anybody's able to solve any of them. And this is the first that has somebody claiming a solution. Perlman posted papers on the preprint archive in 2000 and 2003 giving a solution. They're quite short papers, 39 pages, 22 pages, 7 pages for the three articles. There's been a great deal of interest in these papers, and a great deal of effort has been put into trying to determine whether the argument is correct or not. But there's no final verdict yet, and it looks like this may turn into one of these cases where it goes a very long time before the referees and the experts are able to decide whether these few pages are worthy of the $1 million prize or not. Now, I'm going to start moving from conventional mathematical proofs to computer proofs. There the situation becomes even more difficult and perplexing. The most famous example of a computer proof is the four-color theorem that says that if you take any map, it can be colored with just four colors in such a way that adjacent countries receive different colors. This question was raised initially in 1852. The first proof was presented in the 1880s by Kemp. He was honored by election as a fellow of the Royal Society for his proof. The picture on the right shows a counterexample to Kemp's proof, and it was discovered after about 10 years, and then it went all the way until 1976 before people found a computer proof of this result, and mathematicians have been discussing it ever since. So when we start turning to computer proofs, it raises a large number of questions. First of all, the known bugs in computer code and sometimes in the hardware itself that can cause very expensive problems. For instance, the Intel Pentium chip division error, as I understood, cost Intel ultimately over $500 million. Another famous example is the explosion of the Ariane 5. Bugs are quite prevalent in computer code. There's one bug on average per 100 statements, according to some estimates, and this might translate into, say, 600 bugs in a typical cell phone. And one interesting thing to note here about the software writing culture is that usually software testers don't even try to get all the bugs out of the code. Typically there's some sort of cost-benefit analysis, and if it costs too much to get rid of the bug, you just leave it in. Now, there are reasons to believe that mathematicians will have as many bugs as the industry in general. And for that reason, mathematicians have good reason to be skeptical of computer proofs. Of course, one thing working in the favor of mathematicians is the fact that they tend to take correctness more seriously than the typical programmer. But at the same time, mathematicians are not bound by any coding standards the way programmers in large software houses may be. The programs written by mathematicians are written in a large variety of different languages that run on different platforms, and it makes it very hard for referees to check the correctness of any given piece of code. Mathematicians are often self-taught programmers, and I count myself in that group of self-taught programmers, and that means that we make mistakes that professional programmers would avoid. At the same time, a mathematician typically doesn't have the assistance of people whose job it is to find the errors and debuggers and so forth, and errors are introduced in that way. Another reason that code can show up in mathematical proofs is that the software used by mathematicians is also often specialized with a small audience. Errors that would be discovered by a large community of users will go unnoticed. Let me just jump ahead for a moment, talk about the computer code and the proof of the Kepler conjecture, when the graduate student, Sam Ferguson, who was working with me, was asked at a conference how likely he thought it was that there was a bug someplace in the computer code that was used, that in the computer code that was used in the proof of the Kepler conjecture that Sam and I were involved in. Sam answered that he thought the chance of a bug in the code was virtually 100%. Later in 2000, I found a bug in the computer code. Sam was right. This created a number of extra cases in the Kepler conjecture that had been overlooked. Fortunately, these new cases could be treated exactly by the same arguments that were used in the original 1998 proof. We were quite fortunate, though, that this bug turned out not to matter ultimately. Let me just mention quickly a couple of other results in that use computers. The Foucault theorem was the first major theorem, but recently there have been many other proofs that rely on computers, and these are important results in a variety of different areas of mathematics. So I just wanted to quote Gontier here, who says that our experience with computers is that once given a consistent set of instructions, they compute consistently. It's just hard to give them a consistent set. One problem that was solved fairly recently by computers is called the double bubble conjecture. It's a classical theorem in mathematics that if you want to enclose a given volume with the least amount of surface area, the way to do it is with a sphere. This is the classical isoperimetric inequality. If you want to do the same thing, now enclosing two volumes with two sphere-like objects, you can do better than enclosing them separately with two separate spheres, because they can share part of their boundary together and save some of the surface area by sharing a boundary piece. And so the conjecture became that a double bubble was the best way to enclose two equal volumes. And the double bubble is just what you think it is. It's two round bubbles that have been stuck together in such a way that the angles at which they meet form 120 degree angles. So this proposed solution appears in 1911 with David Boies in his book on soap bubbles. And it was finally proved by Haas, Hutchings, and Schlafly in 1995. And the proof is a mixture of computer calculations and traditional paper and pencil methods. I'll talk about my own work in sphere packings in a moment, but I should say that also in 24 dimensions, work has been done on sphere packings. It's a little harder to imagine in 24 dimensions than in 3. In this work, they showed that a particular arrangement of spheres that it's called the Leech lattice, and this is important actually in the classification of finite simple groups, because it's the symmetries of this particular lattice that give one of the simple sporadic groups that shows up in the classification. And this work by Kumar and Cohn relies on about 6 hours of computer calculation. This is one I don't know as much about, so I'll skip over it quickly. But in 2002, Will Tucker solved one of Snell's 14th problem. Snell gave a list of problems for the new millennium that he intended to be something like the Hilbert problems that were proposed in 1900. And this is the first of the problems to be solved, and it was solved by using a computer and interval arithmetic. Okay, Kepler conjecture. So this is a problem that is very easy to state. It was originally proposed by Kepler in 1611. It has to do with sphere packing. So I take congruent balls in three-dimensional space, and the problem is just how do I arrange those balls in such a way that there's as little wasted space between them as possible. And the answer is a fairly simple solution that has somehow disappeared from the right-hand side of this computer glitch. Okay. So it's just the arrangement you see at a fruit stand of oranges in a pyramid arrangement. And Kepler said that this would be the best arrangement possible, so that in no other arrangement could we fit more balls into the same space. This is not the only arrangement that does this well, but you can do no better than this. It was solved finally in 1998 by a graduate student, Sam Ferguson, and me. The proof, well, it's quite small, only 300 pages compared to, say, the 10,000 pages or more involved in the classification of finite simple groups, compared to the 1,728 pages in Almgren's big theorem in regularity. There is a computer component to this proof. There are three major computer programs that need to be run as part of the verification. There are about 40,000 lines of computer code there. Part of the problem is an optimization problem using linear programming. These are linear programs that involve about 200 variables and maybe 2,000 constraints, and that's a very small problem by industrial standards. But to store all of the data from the 100,000 or so linear programs takes about 3 gigabytes of storage space. So I don't want to talk to you too much about the structure of the proof. What I'd rather do is tell you a little bit about what happened after we finished and the process of checking this proof for correctness. Twelve referees were assigned to check the proof. A conference was organized for the sake of the referees to give them an overview of the proof. Sam and I gave lectures to them for a week or so. After a year, I heard back from the chief referee that they were 99% convinced that the proof was correct and that they were optimistic. After 4 years, I heard back from the referees that they were 99% convinced that the proof was correct and that they were exhausted. And the refereeing project at that point was abandoned. As I understand the situation, the computer code was never carefully checked for bugs. The editors took the unusual step of publishing an abridged version of the proof anyway, which did not appear until just November of last year. That was the abridged version of the proof. The unabridged version will finally appear in July of this year. So as a result of the proof of the Kepler conjecture, the journal has changed its policy on computer proofs. It will no longer try to verify the correctness of computer code. One of the editors said last year that it is impossible to find peers who are willing to review the computer code. Instead, the journal review computer calculations at the same level as scientific experiment, in their words, where only the general methods are published, and belief in the calculation done by computers to come by independent corroboration of the result rather than a mathematical examination of the computer code. As I understand it, the purpose in publishing an abridged version was to somehow separate out the computer portions of the proof from the non-computer portions of the proof and to publish only the computer portions. But that, in fact, is not what happened. The computer calculations in the proof of the Kepler conjecture is something that cannot be pulled out and quoted as a single major lemma. Rather, the calculations enter throughout the proof of the theorem in the fine details of the proof, and it's quite impossible to separate things out this way. So, of course, the journal can make whatever policy it wants, but there's an enormous difference on one hand making a serious attempt to verify the computer code in a proof, even if that attempt fails, and on the other hand, announcing in advance as a matter of policy that no attempt will ever be made in the future. Many calculations can be done either by hand or by computer, depending on what the author of the theorem wishes to do. And if it's been announced in advance that a calculation can be done, that calculations done by hand will be checked carefully in the usual way, but the computer calculations will be allowed through without review, there develops a strong incentive to push sloppy calculations over into the computer code in order to avoid the extra work of writing up the sloppy calculations for publication. In complex proofs, especially those involving a computer, there's a high probability of a logical error someplace in the proof. In setting up the proof of the Kepler conjecture, it became important to design the proof in a way that the proof would be fault tolerant. You want to know, so in a traditional mathematical proof, there are no mistakes, and so there's no need for the design of the proof to be fault-tolerant. But in a computer proof, there's a large probability of mistakes somewhere or another, and it really pays to design the proof differently so that the proofs will be fault-tolerant. Let me just give one example. So there are a large number of inequalities that get used in the proof. Those inequalities are proved by computer using a method called interval arithmetic. If one of those inequalities would turn out to be incorrect, it would, of course, hurt the proof of the Kepler conjecture. And so to make this fault tolerant, even though we gave a computer proof using interval arithmetic, at the same time, we studied these inequalities numerically in a non-rigorous way just to get independent confirmation of these particular results. So my response to this whole episode of this refereeing process is quite different from the journal. My response has been to turn to what is called formal proofs. So in a formal proof, a computer checks every single logical step of a proof all the way back to the fundamental axioms and rules of inference. Formal proof is too long to be carried out by hand. Even with a moderately sized proof, it's quite easy for the number of inferences to run into the millions. And so with any formal proof, it's necessary to perform a computer audit of all of the steps to make sure that no steps have been overlooked. For a long time, it was believed by mathematicians that formal proofs were simply not possible. For instance, if you read in Bourbaki's theory of sets, Bourbaki states on page 11 that formalized mathematics cannot in practice be written down in full. We shall therefore very quickly abandon formalized mathematics. Now, while it is impossible to write down moderately sized formal proofs by hand, they can be checked step by step by computer, and computers have become then the natural host of formalized mathematics. So my feeling is just as an architect needs to use more reliable materials in building a skyscraper than a small house, a mathematician needs to use more reliable certification processes on a large complex proof than on a simple proof. And that's the reason I've become interested in the subject of formal proofs. For a long time, mathematicians were not too interested in formal proofs. It was really an area studied by logicians and computer scientists. And the reason for that was that the subject was not sufficiently well developed to prove anything that a working mathematician cared about. The situation has changed rather dramatically in the past few years. Let me just give you a few examples. The most spectacular example is the four-color theorem. This was a big project by... things have just collapsed up here. The four-color theorem was formally verified by Georges Gontier in 2004. What this means is that the four-color theorem is now one of the most carefully checked theorems in all of mathematics. I would consider it much more carefully checked than, for instance, the proof of Fermat's last theorem or some theorem of that nature. Another formal proof that was done recently is the prime number theorem by Jeremy Avigan at CMU in 2004. When I got involved in the area, I sat down and proved what's known as the Jordan curve theorem. This is an example of a theorem that's extremely easy to state, but relatively difficult to prove. Proof goes all the way back to 1893, but it's so the statement is that you draw any simple closed curve in the plane. So this is a curve that you can draw just by putting the pencil down on a sheet of paper and not lifting it and coming back to where you started from in such a way that you don't cross the path along the way so that you get just a big loop. And the theorem says that that loop, that simple closed curve, separates the plane into exactly two components, an interior and an exterior region. So everybody will say this is obvious, that you draw a loop on a piece of paper, there's an inside and an outside. But this turned out to be really quite a difficult thing initially to establish, even though there are some proofs now that are quite elementary. And this work translated that proof over to a formal proof. And what that means is that this result in topology now looks like a long computer program of about, say, 40,000 lines of computer code. Another one that was done last year is the Brouwer fixed point theorem, which is a well-known result in topology again. It says, for instance, that if I take a sheet of paper and crumple it up and set it down on top of an uncrumpled sheet of paper, there's some point of the crumpled sheet that lies exactly over the corresponding point on the uncrumpled sheet. That's the fixed point theorem. One result that I'm quite pleased about is this result that was done just in December of 2005 that proves the correctness of one of the programs used in the proof for the Kepler conjecture. So here we finally have examples where this formal theorem proving technology is doing for us what the referees were simply incapable of doing. The referees very quickly gave up on the effort of trying to verify the correctness of the code, but here using these formal methods, Tobias Nipkow and his student Gertrude Bauer were able to prove this part of the Kepler conjecture correct. So these are some results. There are many earlier results that you might mention of formal proofs in mathematics, such as the fundamental theorem of algebra, fundamental theorem of arithmetic, fundamental theorem of calculus. So the system that I used, there are several systems that do formal proofs. I use one called Whole Light, which was implemented by somebody by the name of John Harrison, who was then at Cambridge and now at Intel. The program is written in such a way that it becomes self-checking after the first 1,000 lines of computer code. Of course, with any of these formal systems, you have to make sure that the system itself is sound. Otherwise, you really don't get much of an advantage by using it. So in the first 1,000 lines of code or so, you need to state the axioms and the fundamental rules of inference. And if you were to state one of the axioms incorrectly, it would have disastrous results inside the system because you would be able to prove possibly anything at all if you get the axiom incorrect. But the type system of the language is such that once you get the first lines of code correct, it becomes self-checking after that and produces highly reliable results. So I asked the question, do we hope that the 1,000 lines of Hoolite are bug-free? Well, we don't know for a fact that they're bug-free. A few bugs were found early on in the system that were serious in the sense that they compromised the system and you were able to prove incorrect theorems as a result. But they were easily fixed, and you didn't have to change any of the other computer code as a result. And so now I guess there's some hope that things are correct. So my feeling is that this type of technology, this process of checking proofs using formal methods, is much more reliable than what can be obtained by the traditional process of checking by referees. Even if computers have bugs, I don't know. I have a great deal of confidence in what these systems are doing. Let me just, in conclusion, just show you what this looks like. So it's just a computer program, but it takes about 3 minutes for this to run, and what it does is it's starting from the fundamental axioms and rules of inference of mathematics. And in the course of about 3 minutes, it uses, so there's an axiom of infinity that it uses to construct the natural numbers. It constructs the basic rules of logic. It constructs the properties of natural numbers. Then it constructs the real numbers. Then it constructs the basic properties of real numbers all the way up through, say, the fundamental theorem of calculus. Where every single inference is checked all the way back to the axioms. And then this file here I have on top is just gives an example of one of the crucial files in the kernel of the system. If there's a bug, if you want to find that the system is incorrect or inconsistent, the first place you should look is in these first 227 lines of code. And this is, these 227 lines of code state all of the different rules of inference in the system. So you can just take a look at the code. If there's a problem with an inference, you can find it there. Okay, so thank you. I think I'll stop there.